In 1914, there was a man over in Newport, in Monmouthshire actually, who was a sailor, and he was only 18 years old. His name was Blackborough, and he took a boat called the Golden Gate boat, and he took it down to South America. And this again, 1914, it was just the beginning of the First World War, just shortly before, I think it was, that he actually took the boat down there. And as he was coming into Montevideo, the boat floundered on a breakwater that was on the outside of the harbour there, and it actually went down. I don't know whether there's anybody killed on the actual boat as he was going in there, but he and his friend, William Bakewell was a friend of his. They managed to escape anyway without any problem and got to Montevideo. Now, Montevideo is actually in Uruguay, I think it is, by an estuary that's going into Argentina and Buenos Aires. And rather than try and find another boat in Montevideo, he went across with his friend to Buenos Aires and looked for a boat there, and tried to find a boat home, obviously, trying to find an English boat that would eventually take him home. And he chose a wooden ship. A wooden ship was about 144 foot long altogether. The name of the ship was Endurance, and his captain was Frank Worsley, and there were 27 men on board altogether. And this ship was going down towards Antarctica, dropping some people off, and then coming back and going back to Britain. So he was going to go ahead and catch the boat with a slight trip down to Antarctica. And on the way, the thing is that William Bakewell actually got on. He managed to get on there because they were a bit short-staffed. They'd actually had to get rid of some people. But Perce Blackborough didn't get on. He was only 18 years old. I reckon he was too young. So he actually got himself smuggled on board, and he stowed away. He hid in a locker. So he therefore decided he was going to go ahead and get on this boat anyway with his friend. And if you turn over with me, just turn over to Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14. Because, you know, when we first get baptized, we think we know what is actually happening, what we're going to be signing up for. But do we really? Do we really understand just what it is that we're signing up for? Because here in Luke chapter 14, notice in verse 28, it says, "For which of you intending to build a tower sits not down first and counts the costs, whether he really has enough to finish it? Lest haply after he has laid the foundation, he's not able to finish it, all the behold begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build, and he was not able to finish. Or what king, going to make war against another king, sits not down first, and consults whether he's able to with 10,000 to meet him that comes against him with 20,000? Or else, when the other is yet a great way off, he sends off an ambassador, and desires conditions of peace. So likewise, whoever it is of you that forsakes not all that he has, cannot be my student." And I just wonder whether we, when we first get baptized, whether we really sit down and say, yeah, we'll go ahead and we'll stay the course. But, you know, these years that we now find ourselves in, we never, ever expected to find ourselves in there. The broadcast we just listened to was, 30, 40 years old? We never expected to be here still. And the years up ahead, we're looking at the economic situation in Europe and the Greek situation, and it is, you know, it is a bit of a precipice that we're looking down. He says, "Likewise, whoever it is of you that forsakes on all that he has cannot be a disciple. Salt's good, but if the salt loses its flavor, what are you going to salt it with? Because you need to be salted. It's neither fit for the land nor for the dunghill, but men cast it out, and he that has ears to hear, let him hear." Now, Blackborough, as he was on this particular, he got onto this boat, and he managed to stay hidden for about 3 days. But there was another leader on that boat. It wasn't the captain, was Frank Worsley. But the leader was a man called Ernest Shackleton. And that particular leader, he'd been down to the Antarctic a number of times before. And he he certainly knew a great deal about the Antarctic, and they were planning to actually drop him off in the, with the Weddell Sea. They're going to go into the Weddell Sea, get as close to the land as possible, far south as they could go, and then drop Shackleton and a party off. And I think what I'd like to do today is I'd like to just go through the story of Ernest Shackleton. I've done it before, but I think it's about 15 years ago, 20 years ago, something like that, of the Arctic expedition of 1914, because it gives many lessons of endurance and patience and keeping on, keeping on. And today, more than ever, that's what we need to do. That is what we need to do. In fact, it's a vital thing. If you hear as we are in Luke, just turn over a couple of pages to Luke 16. And in Luke 16, Christ is actually using an example, a carnal example, as we have given to you before. He said unto his disciples, there was a certain rich man that had a steward, and the same was accused unto him that he'd wasted his goods. And he called him and said to him, how is it that I hear of this? Have you given account of your stewardship? For he may no longer be a steward. And the steward said within himself, what shall I do? My Lord takes away from me the stewardship. I can't dig, to beg I'm ashamed. I'm resolved what to do, that when I'm put out of the stewardship, I may receive into me into their houses. So he called every one of his Lord's debtors, and he actually went behind his master's back, and he ingratiated himself with the debtors, saying, you know, how much do you owe my Lord? And he says, okay, 100 measures of oil. He said, take them at your bill, and you sit down quickly and write 50. So he got them involved with the deception. And then he said to another one, how much you owe in 100 measures of wheat? Okay, you take your bill and write 80. And the Lord commended the unjust steward because he had done wisely. For the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. Now, the reason this boat was called Endurance is that Shackleton's family motto was, by endurance we conquer. That was, it's the Latin. I don't know what the Latin is, but anyway, it was, by endurance we conquer. And certainly, every indication that you read about this particular individual, he had an endurance that goes beyond normal. It just goes way beyond normal. I mean, to be a polar explorer at that time, you needed endurance, believe you me. He had actually achieved the furthest south of anybody on Earth. I think also, up to a very recent time, he was also the person that achieved the greatest distance north of anybody on Earth. So he held the two records simultaneously, north and south. And then I think American actually went to the North Pole. And Adamson got to the South Pole. But what he was planning to do in this particular expedition was to go across the pole. You're going to start from the Weddell Sea and go right the way across the pole onto the other side, and had another party waiting for him on the other side. The only thing is that Blackborough, you know, he came on board, and he looked forward to sailing down to the Antarctic, seeing some of the Antarctic, and dropping Shackleton and his party off, and then sailing back. In fact, what happened was, on January, Tuesday, January the 19th, he'd already been to South Georgian Island and provisioned himself there. But on the 19th of January, 1915, the pack ice caused, you know, encroached on the ship, and the actual ship got stuck in the Weddell Sea. And it was then drifting. The Weddell Sea, in fact, is, if you imagine the Atlantic, the South Atlantic, and the Atlantic's coming down, and it's about 30 degrees west of Greenwich, and then 60 degrees west of Greenwich, and these two lines therefore converge on the South Pole. Well, the Weddell Sea lies between those two lines. You've heard of the Roaring Forties. I mean, the Roaring Forties are the 40th parallel that goes across the top, and ships don't go down because you're looking there about the 60s and 70s, the Roaring 60s and 70s when you get down there. And in that kind of triangle is the Weddell Sea. What happens is the Roaring 40s or the Roaring 60s or 50s and 60s are roaring across from west to east over the top. And if you imagine the South America as it comes down, how it curves out towards the east. On Antarctica, the land there also curves out towards the east because the winds and the currents have nothing to stop them. roaring past that, and they literally roar around the entire globe on that area from about the 40s all the way down to the south. The Weddell Sea, however, what happens is that these currents and the wind is pushing the ice against the eastern shore, and then going around in like an eddy. So in fact, what happens is you can go down the shore of the Weddell Sea, and you can go right the way down to almost to the end of it, before you start running into ice. In fact, that's what his plan was, to go right the way down, drop Shackleton off, and then come all the way back out again. But what happened was the ice packed in around the boat because there was more ice that year, and it then was brought, the current was going down south, and it took them further and further and further down south in the Weddell Sea. And it was midsummer, you know, January, February time is midsummer down there. And they started then to drift, and they drifted then not just down to the south, but then back again along the western shore. And they therefore were in this eddy, and the pack ice packed around the ship. So they were drifting actually from the midsummer, and Blackborough was actually with this particular party, drifting from the midsummer, which is around the January, February time when they first got stuck. Then they started to drift north, and they actually drifted about 1,300 miles north, packed in ice. And during that particular time, and Endurance was a particular type of ship. It was a ship made of oak and mountain fir, and the actual thickness was 2.5 feet thick at the thickest points of laminated oak and fir. Now, about the 8th of May, they lost sight of the sun, because that is going into winter, and therefore for 79 days there was no sun at all. And they didn't see the sun again until the 26th of July, when a crescent just started to appear, and the pack ice was all around the ship. They were able to get off the ship and actually walk onto the ice. And remember, what I'm talking about sea ice, I'm not talking about ice. You know, over here in the UK, we get salt, and we sprinkle it on our roads to melt the ice. This is ice made of salt water. It's actually salt water that is frozen, and the ice can be anything up to 6 or 10 feet thick in places. So this pack ice, as the ship was brought round along the western coast of the Weddell Sea, the pack ice obviously is being pushed. Literally, you imagine this is something 1,000 miles long, or maybe 900 miles across. With the forces involved of this, the forces of the currents and the forces of the pack ice and the pressures involved on this boat were absolutely phenomenal. And so what happened was that the back of the ship actually was pushed out of the ice completely. The front of the ship was crushed under the weight of the ice going around it. And even though it was 2.5 feet thick, it nevertheless succumbed to the enormous pressures that were there. And eventually, 27th of October 1915, the abandoned ship command was given, because literally water was coming in, and the pumps weren't able to cope with it. They had actually buckled the deck. The deck had actually buckled completely. As you say, it was 20 feet up in the air. The back end of the ship was 20 feet up in the air. The front end was underwater, or under the ice, and the water was underneath it, about 6 foot down into the water. And they didn't have a sat-nav. There was no sat-nav, there was no radio, and nobody knew what was going on, because they thought they would be dropped off and then come back out again. The sealers on South Georgia, they went ahead and said, look, or the whalers there, they said, look, the ice is very thick this year. But here they are, the nearest land that they've got with any human habitation was 1,200 miles to the north in the end of Tierra del Fuego and the end of the South America, and the Falkland Islands at the end of South America. And you know, 1,200 miles for us is about from here to Algeria, so here to the North African coast. So they were on the ice. There was 6 feet of ice. There was about 6,000 feet of water underneath them. It's a very deep area of sea. They were completely cut off. And what they therefore had to do was they had to get rid of all non-essential items. Turn over to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. You know, this isn't what Blackburn signed up to, but it was, because he was going, it was reputed that when he was actually found as a stowaway, Shackleton really laid into him verbally. He verbally, cut him up one side and down the other. And he said, you know, you realize that, sometimes in these polar expeditions, we get very, very hungry and stowaways are eaten first. And Blackburn apparently said to him, he says, well, they get an awful lot more meat off you, sir. So it was a case that he was looking forward to his trip back home. But here in Hebrews chapter 12, we are looking forward to the kingdom of God, being teachers in the kingdom of God. But between now and then, we've got to realize that there is a rough ride. There is endurance involved. And here in chapter 12, it says, therefore, seeing that we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. And it is patience that is necessary. It is patience. And looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher, the originator, the originator and the finisher of our faith, or of faith generally, and who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. You see, we've got somebody that actually went ahead before us, and is there with us as we go through the difficulties that we go through in life. And in this case, they did have Shackleton. Shackleton had been a polar explorer. He'd been with Scott initially down and at the time that Scott obtained the further south. And then he'd been down himself with his own expedition and gone even further south obtained that. That was just a few years before. So the first thing that actually happened that when they abandoned ship and they found themselves completely isolated, although the ship was still there, it was on such an angle that they couldn't sleep, they couldn't actually use it at all. The first thing they did was to get rid of all non-essentials. There were four pups that were immediately shot because they had dogs with them. And Shackleton basically got a gold cigarette case that he had, threw it in the snow, a whole bunch of gold sovereigns, threw it in the snow. And he said, look, I want everything that is not essential. You just discard it. And realistically, we have got to be prepared to do that. We've got to, there's nothing that we have in this life, in this world, that we need to hang on to and say, oh, well, yes, we'll go ahead and discard everything, but not this. We have got to be able to realize that as we read before, whoever doesn't forsake all that he has, he's not worthy to be a disciple. He's not worthy to be a student. And it is literally that we count the cost before we start. So many times we don't. And yet it's not something that we need to be apprehensive of, because as they had Shackleton there, Shackleton had been in these situations before. He'd just about starved. He'd have to, hunting for supply drops on the way back from the further south that he went previously. But so he realized that he had to go ahead and shed every weight and run with patience the race that was set before them. And we also shed every weight and run with patience the race set before us. What they did have is they had boats, because they realized they were going to get into open water eventually. And they began dragging boats over the pack ice. Now, the pack ice, they've got gullies. You imagine the amount of pressure that's involved and the amount of the heave that they would have that would come off the pack ice. Well, they had these boats, which were the three boats that they had, which were a ton each. Each one weighed a ton. Plus they had sledges and the dogs pulling the sledges. And they managed to drag them 1¾ miles. But then they basically gave up. They said, this is ridiculous. So the 1st of November, they actually set up camp at a place called, they called it Ocean Camp. It was a thick ice floe that they set up camp on. And they, therefore, were waiting, and the ice was actually moving between 2 and 5 miles a day, being moving up towards the north along the side. They couldn't see the coast. I mean, they couldn't see the western seaboard at all. But they could with a sextant, sense the movement that was there. Now, they went back to find more supplies, and they got more supplies off the boat. They actually hacked their way through the bulkheads, and they hacked their way through the galley roof into the stores below, and they dragged out as much as they could possibly carry. So they were quite fairly well equipped there. But nevertheless, on the 21st of November, Endurance finally sank. It just, you know, they could see it from the camp that they were, you know, 1 3/4 miles away. The Endurance disappeared underneath the ice, underneath, it went down the 6,000 feet to the bottom. And they actually went back to try and see where it had been, and they couldn't find the place. It was literally, it was as if it had never existed at all. The whole thing had gone. So here they were, 1,000 miles or so away from the nearest habitation, and they had no radio, nobody knew about them. Anything that they had to do under their own steam. And you know, here was this stowaway who reckoned he was going to get a trip back to the UK, now finding himself in a very different position altogether. And here in 1 Peter, turn over to 1 Peter chapter 4. In 1 Peter chapter 4, it says in verse 12, it says, "Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, or test you, or prove you, as though that some strange thing happened to you." So taking on board, you know, when we do count the costs, realize that there will be difficult trials and difficult times. But just as they had Shackleton, we have Jesus Christ, who is a living head of the church. And we need to understand and realize that if we are in contact with God, if our prayer life is such that we are in contact with God, he will not let us down, whatever may come. Because this economic situation that we're going into at this present time, it is going to have some repercussions, and we're going to have to live through this. And it's easy, you know, easy enough me reading about Shackleton and the time that they went through, because now it's afterwards, I know what happened, you know, I'd seen the ending. But during the time, can you imagine what went through Blackburn's mind? I mean, what went through his mind? The boat had gone, you know, not only had he been wrecked in Montevideo, but he got onto a boat. He now found himself, instead of being at the 30th parallel, or whatever Buenos Aires does, he's now at about the 60th or 70th parallel, on an ice floe with a boat 6,000 feet below him. You know, it's don't think, as he says, concerning the fiery trial, it's to test you as though some strange thing happened to you, but you rejoice in as much as you are partakers of Christ's sufferings. In other words, you're now in the kind of explorer range, the same kind of thing that Christ went through, that when his glory shall be revealed, you may be glad also with exceeding joy. You'll be part of the rescue that will take place. If you be reproached for the same name of Christ, happy are you, for the spirit of glory and of God rests on you. On their part he is evil spoken of, but on your part he is glorified. But let none of you suffer as a murderer, or a thief, or an evildoer, as a busybody in other men's matters. And yet if any man is suffer as a Christian, then let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God on this behalf. So we need to realize that, yes, we can't see what is going to happen between now and when Christ returns, but our focus is on that return of Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ is with his church to this day. He is actually active right now. He will work with us, and he will mold us and shape us so that we are ready for the time in the future. But as I say, it's easy looking at it when you're in the future. When you're going through it, that's a different matter. And here, when Endurance sank, they probably, you know, Blackborough almost certainly felt, you know, why me? See, what it was the different types of men that were required for the journey. There were about 5,000 applicants in London for the various people that were, and there were only about 28, 30 men altogether. The different types that would apply, there were sailors, the university dons, there were Yorkshire fishermen, there were all kinds of different people that applied. But Shackleton, he would weed out from the letters a certain number, and then he would have interviews with a certain other number, but he specifically selected them. And it wasn't, it was almost like a gut feeling that he would use, because he knew he had to build these people together as a unit, as a group. For the future hardships that they were going to have to go through. And so he was actually looking for certain qualities that, you know, academically you wouldn't find. And here in Colossians, turn over to Colossians chapter 3. Because Christ also, apart from the fact that he selects people according to the lack of ability, he is looking for certain qualities. He's looking for certain things that are going to be there in the very temple at the time. And as it says here in Colossians 3, it says, "If you then be risen with Christ, verse 1, seek those things which are above, where Christ sits on the right hand of God. Set your reflections on the things above, not on the things that are on the earth. For you are dead, and your life is hidden with Christ in God." The previous lives that these men had were gone, were finished. You know, whether they might have been a university professor, there might have been a sailor, he might have been a Yorkshire fisherman. I mean, what's the good of a Yorkshire fisherman trudging through ice and snow in the Weddell Sea with a boat 6,000 feet below you? That life was now past. Now, from that point forward, there was a converted type of life that was needed, a different type of life that was needed. And it says here, "For you are dead, and your life is hidden with Christ in God." He's looking for something different. He's looking for a conversion process, ready for the kingdom of God, ready for what is ahead. "When Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then shall you also appear with him in glory. Mortify, put to death therefore your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry." In other words, the things that went on in the past, leave them behind. Get rid of them, because the life that you have now, from this point, from the point of conversion forward, it's going in a certain direction. It's not necessarily going to be the same way as you were before. In fact, it cannot be the same way as you and I were before. For it says, "For which thing's sake the wrath of God comes on the children of disobedience." In other words, we can't be like that. We can't be the old person that we were. "In which also you walked in some time when you lived in them. But now you also put off all these: anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy communication out of your mouth." In other words, get the spiritual side also sorted out. You got rid of the physical side initially when you first were converted, but now you and I need to work on the spiritual side, because the spiritual side also needs this conversion process applied to it. "Lie not one to another, seeing that you have put off the old man with his deeds, and you've put on a new man, which is renewed in knowledge after the image of him that created him." And so we find these individuals drifting on pack ice at 2 to 5 miles a day along the western coast of the, again, they weren't visible, they couldn't see the western coast, but along the western side of the Weddell Sea as it was going up, going north. They had a previous life. They were sailors. They were university dons. They were Yorkshire fishermen. They were a stowaway as well. But from that point forward, there had to be a mental quality. There had to be a mental resilience. There had to be an endurance that was there that really had to be, it was a conversion process that it was necessary. Now, there are a number of words they used for patience. In fact, two are the major ones that they usually use for patience in Greek. And you find in Galatians 5, you can put in your notes, Galatians 5:22, where it talks about long-suffering as part of the fruit of the Spirit. You certainly find that particular word used, which is makrothumos, which is literally long passion. Now, that is one quality that was needed at this time. So here were these individuals. There were sailors, the university dons, the Yorkshire fishermen. They were all melded together as a unit. They now became almost like Arctic explorers. But what they did need, what they needed, and what we also need from Scripture, you certainly find this being the case, is a macrothumos, which is long passion. In other words, you've got a goal that you're trying to go for, and you've got to keep that passion alive. And here, what were they doing on this particular piece of pack ice that they were called, what do they call it, Patience Camp, no, Ocean Camp. They called it Ocean Camp. And they had certain qualities of unesse, but it was really more the other word that is hypomone, which is used within Greek, which means to stay beyunder, stay under, stay beneath. Now, the long passion, macrothumos, is somebody like Randolph Fiennes, who's the climber, you know, who made the comment. He says, when I was climbing, he says, well, what I'm doing is basically I tell myself that I'm going to have to keep doing this forever. There is no end in sight. He's just going to keep slogging away, doing it forever, working towards this goal that he's going to have to be able to climb this mountain. It's like a salmon going up river. When the salmon's going up river, it's got this goal to go ahead and spawn, and anything and everything, you know, dams and waterfalls and everything else, anything in its path is going to be overcome. And that is very much this long passion, this burning desire and drive that is necessary, because we need to make it to become teachers in the world tomorrow. That is a burning desire and passion that we need. But there's another quality as well, this staying beneath or staying under, this slogging away. It's almost like a fisherman that is sitting there on the bank fishing for, I don't know, carp or trout or something else. He sits there with his rod, he's fishing. He's in his nothing box. And he's there, and that's what he's doing, he's fishing. He's patiently waiting for a bite on the end of his hook. It's the kind of thing that you watch a spider in his web. A spider sits there, rigid, waiting. It's got his one of its feet on its web, waiting for the twang as a fly actually comes into the spider web. But it just sits there and it waits. And that really was very much what they needed in this particular camp. This particular camp, which was what was it actually called? I said just a minute ago, Ocean Camp, they called it. They needed to just sit and wait and allow the natural flow of the ice to move them steadily northward. Now, the trouble is that waiting is a difficult job. Turn over to Genesis 12, Genesis chapter 12. It's a difficult job for all of us, and here is the greatest example humanly of faith that we've been given, which is Abraham, and yet he even had a struggle waiting. He had a struggle with this hupomone side of endurance, hupomone side of patience. He says, now the Eternal, that's Genesis chapter 12, now the Eternal had said to Abraham, get out of your country and from your kindred and from your father's house to a land that I will show you, and I'll make you of a great nation, I'll bless you and make your name great, and you'll be blessed, and your name will be a blessing. Now that was actually said to him, it was said actually back in Ur of the Chaldees, and it says here, so Abram, verse 4, Abram departed as the Eternal had spoken to him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. Now Haran was to the north of Ur of the Chaldees. He'd stopped there waiting for his father Terah to die, but when he actually came out of Ur, notice in verse 30 of the preceding chapter, he already knew that Sarah was barren. So he knew there'd been some time, obviously, as a husband and wife, and Sarah was barren. He knew that. And yet it was that in Ur of the Chaldees, he'd been told to get out of his father's house and become a great nation. I'll make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. So all these years, so whatever number of years, he was 75 years departing from Haran, what was he, 50, 60? He'd been several years before. He'd been in Haran for a while, presumably becoming wealthy. If you notice over in chapter, let's have a look, in chapter 15, it says, "And after these things," in verse 1, "the word of the Eternal came to Abram in a vision, saying, 'Don't fear, Abram, I'm your shield and your exceeding great reward.' And Abram said, 'Lord Eternal, what will you give me, seeing I go childless, and the steward of my house is going to become my heir?' And Abram said, 'Behold, to me you have given no seed, and one born in my house is my heir. And behold, the word of the Eternal came to him, saying, This shall not be your heir, but he that shall come forth out of your own bowels shall be your heir.' And he brought him forth abroad, and he said, 'Look now towards heaven, tell the stars if you are able to number them.' And he said to them, 'So shall your seed be.' And he believed in the Eternal, and he counted it to him for righteousness." So he trusted in God. And, you know, he had to therefore wait. And, you know, God could have gone ahead and opened Sarah's womb. He could have gone ahead at any time and opened Sarah's womb. But he didn't. He allowed him to wait until all real hope of having a child had gone. And before he granted him the blessing of a child. You see, Abraham had to wait. He had to... this hupomone side type of waiting, to stay under, to stay beneath, just to stay hanging on there. And this is very, very difficult. It's going to be very difficult indeed for any one of us. And what have we been now? 26 years from Mr. Armstrong's death? 26 years from January, wasn't it? Mr. Armstrong died. We never, ever expected to be here. But we do still have to wait and wait until God's time is right. And is it going to be this year? Is it going to be by the end of this year? Are we going to be in a totally different situation? We could well be. And then we may look on the time that we've been waiting and thinking, boy, if only we were back there again. It may well be. But it says in chapter 16, verse 1, "Now Sarah, Abram's wife, bore him no children, and she had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. And Sarah said to Abram, 'Behold, now the Eternal have restrained me from bearing. I pray, go into my maid.'" So Sarah was the one that made the... suggestion, and he went along with it. Abraham went along with it and thought, well, maybe this is the way it's gone. In other words, he didn't wait patiently. Now, he'd already been told by God. He brought him aboard. He said, "Look at the heavens, see the stars, so shall your seed be." You don't have to, you know, the indication is that you didn't have to go ahead and have a child with a handmaid, that it would come in the normal course of things. It says in if you go on to chapter 21, and just read a little bit there, because this caused trouble, it caused difficulty, it caused an upset. In chapter 21, verse 5, it says, "And Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him." And verse 9, "And Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, which she'd borne unto Abraham mocking. Therefore she said to Abraham, 'Cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac.' And the thing was very grievous in Abraham's sight because of his son." So it caused trouble, it caused difficulty, it caused trauma, even when Isaac was born, because he hadn't waited, because he hadn't been patient, because the patience, the endurance of a different type, it's not just having a goal and going for that goal, you know, all the time being dogged in going for the goal. It is also a case sometimes we just need to be able to wait. Sometimes we need to be able to allow time to go past. And this was the case regarding Shackleton. What in fact occurred is that they were stuck in the Weddell Sea, and they were at Ocean Camp, and they had got to this, you know, this ocean camp. It was about 1¾ miles from where the ship had gone down. But people's mental state began to start deteriorating. And Shackleton saw that, because people were not, this hupomone, this staying, continuing under, staying beneath, they weren't. they were starting to disintegrate. And so what he did, he said, okay, let's start trekking again. Let's start going again. And so for 5 days, for the 21st of December, again, it would be light almost right the way through the entirety of every day. They started trekking, but it was the height of summer by that time in the Southern Hemisphere. So the 21st of December, by the time that it came to the 26th of December, the actual ice was melting under the feet. Remember, it was salt water, which was at the basis of this, the frozen salt water. Although there would be ice, which you'd be able to use for fresh water on the surface of the pack ice. And they finally had to give up. They simply could not do it because these three boats, a ton apiece, with all the supplies and everything else, towing over these huge crevasses that were being made by the pack ice. It wasn't possible to carry on anymore. So they came to Patience Camp. Now, this place was not in any way like the previous one. It wasn't as thick, it wasn't as big, it wasn't as level. It was much more slush than everything else. And they had to literally stay there. They stayed there from the 26th of December till the 8th of April. Come the 8th of April, I mean, but on the 23rd of March, they actually saw land. They saw land as the ice was being moved, being pushed about 5 miles, 2 to 5 miles a day, pushed north. They then could see land in the distance as they were going. If they're looking north, it would be on the left, on the western side of them. But Shackleton said, "No, we're not going to," because they even had water there that they could go ahead and launch the boats and try to get there. But had they got there, they would have been bottled in by ice. He said, "No, you couldn't do it." So again, it was a form of patience that was necessary, waiting for the right time, waiting for the right conditions. And so many times, people will many times see various signs and unwisely jump at things, thinking this is the answer that God gives for whatever it is that I've been praying about. But we need wise decisions. Wise decisions, not just out of exasperation, which is so many often the case. It is a case of exasperation that we make our decisions on. So, Patience Camp, it was a shame that they'd actually left the previous camp, but they stayed on that until the 8th of April. Now, on the 8th of April, the pack ice started to break up more and more and more. They actually had cases where the ice would open up underneath somebody's tent. In one case, somebody actually fell down in a sleeping bag into the water below because the ice split underneath the tent. The other about six or seven people in the tent managed to climb, scramble free, but they managed to pull the person out of the sea underneath, and then they got, this was in the middle of the night. And they actually got him walking around because he couldn't dry him off. There's no way of drying him off. You're just walking around while the ice... Remember, salt water now. We're not talking about fresh water freezing. We're talking about salt water freezing on his clothes as would be dropping off as they walked him round, stopping him from actually freezing to death. But in this particular camp, they finally got to the state between the 8th of April and the 11th of April, where they were flow hopping. They were actually launching the boats and then getting off the boats onto another flow for the night, and then coming off the boat onto the water again, and then back onto a flow for the night. And it was a very uncomfortable time because, again, the endurance necessary was phenomenal, quite frankly. In the entire pack ice, and by that time they'd long since left the land. They could no longer see the land. There were waves that would come through about every minute and a half, rollers, 30 feet high, that would roll through the pack ice. So you'd be on this pack ice, and it would move 30 foot up and then 30 feet down again. And all the time, the edges of the pack where you were camping, where you had your tent, where you're trying to cook some food or whatever, would be being eroded, being rubbing against each other. And these 30 foot rollers would come through. So they finally, the 11th of April, they set off and they rode for all they're worth. They're actually heading for a couple of islands, and the last two islands on the peninsula that would go up towards Argentina. And if they didn't hit those islands, if they missed them, then they were just, they were in open ocean, and the chances of survival was minimal. But they had to then start rowing, and they rowed for 5 days. They row, and then they would lash the boats together at night, and then row again some more. And if we turn over to Mark chapter 13, Mark chapter 13, and all this time, Blackborough wondered why on earth he got on as a stowaway in Buenos Aires. And, you know, we, as we go into the future, may wonder, you know, well, why do we, you know, carry on as a member of the church? I didn't bargain for this. Well, okay, but remember that we have our high priest who is with us, and he, you know, is reachable. And God himself is reachable. We can get on our knees, and we must get on our knees daily and keep that contact. That contact is a vital contact. They only had Shackleton. Shackleton with the experience, and they put their trust in this in human being. But we've got to put our trust in God himself. And that's the only real trust that you can, or only an individual that you can put true trust in. But here in Mark chapter 13, in verse 32, it says, "But of the hour, day and hour knows no man, no, not the angels which are in heaven, neither the Son, but the Father." So if we're plugged into the Father, if we're actually on our knees each day saying, "Our Father, who is in on high, who is in heaven, hallowed be your name," and praying to him, he knows. He knows, or at least he certainly knows what he's looking for as to when that's going to be. It says, "Take heed, watch." Chase away sleep is what it means. Don't be sleeping when he returns. Watch and pray. Be alert, for you don't know when the time is. For the Son of Man is as a man taking a far journey, who left his house and gave authority to his servants, and to every man his work, and commanded his porters to watch. And we are. We're doing what we can, news-wise, watching, looking at what the situation is. It looks very close. But he says, "Watch you therefore, for you know not when the master of the house comes." And part of that watching has got to be on our knees. You know, every single one of us has got to make sure. You know, you look at the situation regarding Gethsemane. He says, "Well, couldn't you watch with me for 1 hour?" Every time when he came back and found them asleep. And what he was meaning was watching in prayer, getting on their knees and praying. "When the master of the house comes at even or at midnight or at the cock crowing or in the morning, lest coming suddenly he finds you asleep. What I say to you, I say to all, watch. You be ready. You be alert to what actually is going on." Because they rode for 5 days, and they finally, navigation skills of the captain, Frank Wolseley, were nothing short of phenomenal. I mean, you know, with a sextant in an open boat, with paper charts that he had to try and keep dry, and he was taking sightings of the sun and making his way without any chart table or anything like that, making his way to this particular island, which consisted of cliffs that came out of the sea and went up about 1,000 feet high, and the center of the island is about 3,500 feet. That's the kind of piece of land that they were heading for. But they finally saw the land, and they rowed for it, and they headed for it, and they got to within about 10 miles, and then they discovered that there was a series of currents that were coming off the shore. And for the next 20 hours they rowed. So 20 hours they rowed, and they basically, a storm brewed up, and for 20 hours they rowed, and they just kept on enduring. They kept on going. They just kept on. I mean, what was the alternative? They had no alternative. They were either that, or you give up and you die. Now, some of them did give up. So, you know, one or two of them actually did give up and just couldn't take it anymore. But then the ones that actually gave up, they later came into their own afterwards. Some of them, you know, really, really rose to the task. Some of them didn't. And finally, they landed on Elephant Island on the 16th of April, and there were plenty of penguins and seals on that island, and I mean they were living on seals and penguins and so on anyway. One particular stage when they were actually an ocean camp, I think it was, they killed, I think, about 400 penguins. And they had them, you know, and they used the penguin blubber and the seal blubber as the source of fuel. That's what they were using. They'd actually improvised and made cooking equipment that apparently roared like a jet engine and chugged out black smoke. But so they landed on Elephant Island, and all three boats, they'd lost nobody. Nobody had been lost at all. And they realized, however, that they were moving steadily into the winter time. So now they weren't below the Arctic Circle. It wasn't 72 hours of night time as it would have been if they were below the Arctic Circle. They'd moved out of that area by that time. But they still were in a very precarious position. Nobody would even have remotely thought of looking for them at Elephant Island, because nobody went there. The last people who went there were decades before. There were sealers that had been actually landed on the island, and that was the only known people that had ever landed on that particular island in the past. So what they did is they decided, or what Shackleton did, was he decided that he would set off in one of the boats, the Caird, and he actually would set off for South Georgia. And South Georgia was 800 miles, 700 to 800 miles, to the east of them. Now, they could have gone, it was much shorter to go to Argentina, and much shorter to go to the Falkland Islands, which was just north of them, but it was slightly northwest of them. Now, to go west, remember what they actually had in the way of a boat was a lifeboat. There was no keel on the lifeboat. So what they had to do was, they had a sail, yes, but they would be able to run with the wind. They could go slightly left or slightly, tack slightly to some degree, but there was no way whatsoever that they could go into the wind. They could actually tack into the wind. They couldn't tack north sufficiently to get to the Falkland Islands or to get to South America. So they were going to have to go ahead and set off for an 800-mile open boat journey, and in seas which were notorious. And again, as I say, the Roaring Forties is a legend. And that's many degrees further north. The Forties are further north than Elephant Island, further north than South Georgia. And they set off in the Caird. They put canvas across as a decking to stop the water from getting in. They put rock ballast. They actually used a mast from one of the other boats to reinforce the keel, because all the sailors there had actually seen these type of lifeboats smashed to smithereens by the seas that they were going through on the decks of the ships that they were on. So in other words, they'd go through these seas, the waves which were sometimes 90 feet high would come over the top, and they'd actually smash these kind of boats that they were actually dealing with on the decks themselves. So this area, known as Drake's Passage, it was 30-mile-an-hour waves. Not that's not the wind. I mean, the wind would be more than that, but the actual wave speed was about 30 mile an hour, and as I say, they're about 90 feet waves. And you wonder, looking at the situation, would God have been aware of that? Undoubtedly he was, because it does say that he's aware of a sparrow that falls. So was he not aware of Shackleton? And I see no way that he could not have been aware of this. So what they would do is they would sail with these waves that would suddenly lift them up and then propel them forward, and then they would go down into the trough. And finally, they would then have to sleep, heave to in the night, because they would obviously need the sightings. So they put out a sea anchor, a Voss sea anchor, which is it's like a windsock, basically, that they put into the sea, that you tie a rope onto and put it on the bow on the painter, and you can then pull against that sea anchor and allow them to sit there relatively calm. And one particular night, they felt this the boat sluggish in the water on the sea anchor, and when they actually got out, they found that there was 15 inches of ice all over the boat, and they had to literally get out with axes and hack the ice. And this, again, we're not talking about ice as in normal ice. We're talking about ice of seawater. So the temperature is very much different. Now, we see the things that other people have gone through. Turn over to 2 Corinthians 11. You know, we see these things, we read these things, we're looking at the time ahead of us right now, and we don't need to be worried, we don't need to be fret, we don't need to be scared at all, because, as I said, providing we're on our knees before God, as Psalm 91 that Mr. Armstrong read, we do not need to worry about these things. He will take care of us. He will set his angels over us, and anything that happens will be for a purpose and a reason. But here in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 23, it says, "Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool, and more. In labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequent, in deaths often." Now, he had a particular job to do. He had a job which was second to none, really, in dealing with the Gentiles. It says, "Of the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes, save one." And 5 times he'd been beaten up with 39 stripes. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. Now, stoning was a death penalty. Once I was stoned. 3 times I suffered shipwreck. I mean, I've never suffered shipwreck at all. If any of us suffered a shipwreck or went down with a plane, you know, would we ever get into a plane again? You know, but 3 times he'd suffered shipwreck. "A night and a day I've been in the deep, in journeyings often, in perils of water, perils of robbers, perils of my own countrymen, perils by the heathen, perils in the city, perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, perils among false brethren." People stabbing him in the back. "In weariness and painfulness, in watchings often, hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness." I mean, when the Caird was going in the Drake's Passage, when he was trying to make his way towards South Georgia, Frank Wolseley had to actually take sightings. And the only way he could take sightings was kneeling down in the back of the boat with 2 people holding him round the waist and bracing themselves against either side of the boat and taking the sightings. And the actual charts that he was using were going into pulp because, quite frankly, they were getting so wet. And so he's having to peel each chart. If he lost any of the pages of the chart, they would, you know, they'd lose the way. That would be it. And basically, if they didn't hit that land at 700 to 800 miles away from Elephant Island, there was 3,000 miles of ocean. You know, there was absolutely no way at all. And they can't turn around because they can't beat into the wind, because they're actually sailing in a lifeboat that had been, you know, made in such a way for them to be able to sail. "Besides those things that are without, with that which comes upon me daily in the care of the church, who is weak and I'm not weak? Who is offended and I burn not? I don't burn with indignation." Words, I've got human emotions just the same as anybody else. I have my problems, I have my difficulties. This is Paul speaking. So as we go into the future, we have our difficulties, we have our problems. Yep, you better believe it. And so does Paul, so have other people that have gone before us. So have people who have actually gone before us in a human sense and given the same kind of picture of endurance and that we see within Shackleton. "If I must needs glory, I will glory in the things which concern my infirmities. The God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, which is blessed forevermore, knows that I lie not." So here Paul points out the fact that he had, as he says, you know, three times I suffered shipwreck. A night and a day I've been in the deep. And we've got that record of him being shipwrecked on the island of Malta, and how for 14 days they ran with the wind. They've just been battered with the wind, and after the 14th day he got up and says, "I told you so." Basically, if you read the account in the book of Acts. Turn over to Genesis 32. And if we look in verse 22, Genesis 32, verse 22, it says, "And he rose up that night and took two of his wives and his two womenfolk and his 11 sons, and he passed over the ford Jabbok. And he took them, and he sent them over the brook, and he sent them over all that he had. And Jacob was left alone, and there he wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the," or he struck with force, he karate chopped the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled. He said, let me go. And he says, "No, not until you bless me." He says, "What's your name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he says, "Your name is no more Jacob, but it'll be Israel." So his name was actually changed to Israel that night. And if you do the actual sums as to what, in fact, age he was at that particular time, he was probably 30 when he left from Esau, when he actually got away from Esau and he left at that time. He had to work 7 years for Leah. He had to work 7 years for Rachel. So that's 14 years added on to 30, that's 44. He then had 11 children. Okay, so you'd say say a year between each child, something like that. And he then, turn over to chapter 30, verse 31. It says, and he said, "What shall I give you?" And Jacob said, "You should not give me anything. If you will do this thing for me, I will again feed and keep your flock." So this was after he had had the children. He then went ahead and he had to work for sheep and goats. "And I'll pass through all the flock day by day, moving all the speckled and spotted ones." And in verse 42, notice, 43, it says, "And the man increased exceedingly and had much cattle and maidservants and men servants and camels and asses." In other words, he became very wealthy. Now, it's going to take him at least 10 years to get that kind of wealth together, and probably a good deal longer. So the chances are when his name became Israel, he was at least 65, and probably he could have been as much as 80. But he had to, therefore, endure. He had to, all the things that he went through, he had to go through these things. The word Israel means a prince with God. He persevered. He had endurance. The very, very reason why he was called, his name was changed. And we see that there, that he says, "Your name will no more be called Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince you have the power with God and with men and has prevailed." That's verse 28. Now, these particular men also had to prevail. They had this roaring 50s and 60s that they were going through, this Drake's Passage with these huge waves. And they had storms, they had hurricane-force winds that they were having to deal with. And they had, finally, they did in fact sight South Georgia. They came within sight of South Georgia. And this was the area where the whaling station was. And they got within about, the chance to actually land. And as they were looking to land, they realized that the wind was picking up, and they saw the breaking, the breakers, quite frankly, on reefs. And so they risked, if they went in as they were, they would go onto the reefs, which were unexplored. They had no idea what the reefs were, and they'd be broken up and probably would all lose their lives. And it wouldn't be just them that lost their lives. It would be also the 22 people also left on Elephant Island waiting for them. So they went, turned about, and they went out to sea again. And as they were going out to sea, again gales came up. And for 3 days, there was a violent storm. And all they did was hold their own. They just barely held their own. As I say, they've got no keel. It was a struggle and a fight just to be able to keep in the lee of the island, to be able to keep in areas where they were able to battle against the wave and the storm. And finally, on the 10th of May, they landed. They managed to find a rocky cove that they landed in, and they therefore finally got to dry land, or somewhat dryish land anyway, on South Georgia. Except there was a problem. They landed on the wrong side, and it was the wrong side of the island, and they had to therefore make their way. If they were to go by boat, they'd have to make their way 150 miles round the island to go and actually get onto the other side of the island. And there's no way the Caird, James Caird boat that they had was going to be able to make it at that kind of distance. And in not only was it impossible for them to tack into the wind, because they just simply couldn't do it. They didn't have the keel or the centreboard to be able to do it. But the actual boat itself was breaking up by this time. So they decided that the only way to do it was 29 miles overland. Now, they waited until there was a full moon, and on the 19th of May, three of them set off. They had four ridges. Nobody had ever crossed the island before. Nobody had ever crossed the island. The ridges were 4,000 to 5,000 feet high. Remember, you're looking at 19th of May. You're coming in towards June, which is midwinter. So you've got little daylight. In addition to little daylight, you got screaming cold in that area. It wasn't beyond the Arctic Circle, so they did have some light. They were able to walk. But it was a phenomenal task that they set off to do. And what they actually found is the first ridge, they got to about one and a half... they got right on the top of the ridge, about 4,000 to 5,000 feet up. And they looked on the edge, and it was a 1,500 foot drop. A sheer drop on the edge, and they literally worked their way along it, and yet it was starting to get dark. If they left it till it got dark, they would have frozen to death. The three of them would have frozen. The other two that were left, or four, I think it was, that were left on the below them, wouldn't have been rescued, and neither would the 22 left on the Elephant Island either. So the only thing they could do was actually to let go. What they did was they rolled up their ropes that they had, they put it underneath their backsides, they wrapped legs and arms around each other, and they just set themselves over a, not a cliff, but on a snow slope. And they just had no idea what was below them, and they just they sledged down the slope, and they sledged for about 1,000 feet. 1,500 feet, so they got down into an area where they could carry on. If you turn over to Luke chapter 12, sometimes we have to let go. Sometimes all we can do is just allow God to take over and allow him to lead us. It says in verse 4, it says, "And I say to you, my friends, don't be afraid of them that kill the body, and after that they have no more than they can do." This is now verse 5 of Luke 12. "But I'll forewarn you whom you shall fear. Fear him that after he's killed has power to cast into Gehenna. Yes, I say to you, fear him." That's God himself. So fear to not get on our knees each day. Fear to not open the book and read what he has to say and is saying to us. Fear to not implement what is actually we're reading about, and not to grow in the grace and the knowledge that I was talking about previously. "Aren't five sparrows sold for 2 farthings, and not one of them is forgotten before God? Even the very hairs of your head, they're all numbered. Don't fear, therefore, you're more value than many sparrows." Now, there's talk in people of, there was talk when they actually got onto the other side, that each of them, each of the three climbers going across South Georgia, sensed another person that accompanied them over the time. Now, again, people put it down to hallucination, because they were desperately short of food, desperately short of water, not water so much at that time, but desperately short of sleep, and people therefore reckon they're hallucinating. But you do wonder whether, in fact, God did angelically help them and save them. "But even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Don't fear, therefore, you are more value than many sparrows. Also I say to you, whosoever shall confess me before men shall the Son of Man also confess before the angels of God. But he that denies me before men shall be denied before the angels of God. And whoever shall speak a word against the Son of Man shall be forgiven him, but against whoever blasphemes against the Holy Spirit, it will not be forgiven. And when they bring you into the synagogues, and into the magistrates, and the powers, do not take any thought how or what you shall answer, or what you shall say." So there is a time just to basically allow God to work with us, and to let go. It's been a very similar way to what happened with these three men, with Shackleton and the other two, that when they were crossing these ridges, And they abseil down frozen waterfalls and so on. And again, I don't even know if anybody has managed to cross that particular ridge or that particular route, either before or certainly not before. And I don't know whether anybody has since. But they had no proper climbing gear. They had no crampons. The carpenter had screwed some screws into the boots to give them some kind of purchase on the rocks and everything else that they were walking over. But sometimes, as I say, God expects us to also let go. Not normally. We also need to make sure that we do things logically and rationally, and we don't do what Satan tried to get Christ to do and throw yourself off because he says your angels will give a charge over you, lest you dash your foot against the stone. Now that's Psalm 91, which Mr. Armstrong was talking about. Yet Satan used that psalm against Christ to try and get him to do things which are foolish. But there is a time. And the time is that if we are dragged before the courts, it says, for the Holy Spirit shall teach you in that same hour what you ought to say. We don't have to worry. We don't have to fret. God, again, will be with us. That's a promise. And we don't have to fret at all. It will hold before the authorities. So on the 20th of May, 36 hours later, so they actually climbed for 36 hours up and over four ridges, 4,000 to 5,000 feet high. And the problem was it was getting dark and in certain times and it would freeze. But they finally stumbled. They actually heard the siren go on the whistle, isn't it? The whistle that they on the whaling station. They heard that and they finally made their way in about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Anderson, the station foreman, saw three men walking towards him, and they didn't recognize them at all. And they were walking from inside. The direction they were coming from was not from the harbour, which is where you'd normally see people, new arrivals, come from, but it was from the inside. And they asked for the chief. They actually asked for Anton Anderson. They were taken to another individual. And obviously had a shave and something to eat, and actually arrived in safety. Then immediately went round, I think Worsley actually went round to pick up the others that accompanied them on the journey from Elephant Island to South Georgia. And finally, on the 30th of August, 4 months and 5 days after the boat had actually left, they went and they picked up, after three attempts. They finally, on the fourth attempt, they managed to get through the ice and get to Elephant Island and rescued all 22. Now, Blackborough, the individual who was stowed away, he lost his toes. He basically lost his toes from frostbite. But apart from that, nobody else, virtually everybody had frostbite to some degree, but nobody actually lost anything. So it was a phenomenal feat. If you turn over to 1 Corinthians 9, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, it says in verse 24, it says, know you not that they which run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize. So run that you may obtain. And every man that strives for mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. Now, Shackleton was doing it to be fated as an explorer. That's basically what he was doing it for. And it was a corruptible crown. It was just the accolades from the people that he would be coming in contact with. And in fact, he went back to the Antarctic to try again. And on the way, he died of a heart attack. It was all probably a seal meat and penguin blubber that is causing a problem. But and he was buried out in South Georgia. His wife said that don't bring his body back. Basically, he have a burial on South Georgia. But they to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly, so I fight, not as one that beats the air, but I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. That we do need to get on our knees, that we need to, you know, get up in the mornings and to make sure that we do pray, that we do study, that we do fast occasionally, that we take the time to meditate, that we keep that contact with the captain of our salvation. Because just as Shackleton was the focal point, without Shackleton, those men would have died. No question. Absolutely no question. Many of them, you know, they would have been leaderless. But with Shackleton's drive, and with his endurance, and I personally feel a great deal of spiritual help as well, they managed to survive. Final scripture, Hebrews chapter 10. And in verse 32 it says, But call to remembrance the former days in which after you were illuminated you endured a great fight of afflictions. So the endurance, sometimes we do have to endure things when we're first converted. When we first get that initial love of the truth, and we put up with a great deal. But he says, partly while you were made a gazing stock both of reproaches and afflictions, and partly while you became companions of those that were so used. In other words, you put your money where your mouth was, and you held on to the truth. He says, for you had compassion on me in my bounds, and took joyfully the spoiling of your goods, knowing in yourselves that you have in heaven a better and a more enduring substance, something that's really going to endure, something that's going to really keep going. Cast not away, therefore, your confidence, which has great recompense of reward. For you have need of patience, that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. In other words, it's not just a case of having the goal, and going for the goal. It's also that other quality as well. You have the long passion, that like a salmon trying to go up river, but you also have this this staying under. That you just keep on keeping on completely, week after week, year after year, decade after decade, if necessary. For you have need of patience, and that is that word. I think it's that word. Yeah, stay. That word translated as stay, well, you can be translated as staying beneath, the hupomone, which is the word you use for patience here in verse 36. You have need of that kind of patience, that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. For yet a little while, and he that shall come, and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith, but if any man draw back, my soul will have no pleasure in him. But we are not of those that draw back to perdition, but of those that believe to the saving of the soul.